Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. We have such a treat for you today. So many of you have asked if we would try and get Simon Sebag Montefiore onto the show to talk about the Romanovs, which you all absolutely adored. He came on a couple of weeks ago to talk to us about his new paperbacks, but he has returned. Simon, hello.
Hi, lovely to be back with you, Alex.
Oh, you have no idea how many people have asked us to do this podcast with you on the Romanovs, because you haven't really touched on them beyond the odd mention here and there so far.
No. It's been a while since I've been talking about them or thinking about them. But how nice to be back with this lovely collection of people, the Romanovs.
Absolutely. So we'll talk about some of the most famous ones, and you can tell us about some of the ones that perhaps should get more attention. But I suppose it makes sense, first of all, if we talk about Michael Romanov and 1613 and how this 300-year dynasty got to the throne.
Yes, it started. I mean, they started in 1613 in a very inauspicious way. Russia was a failed state. It had been invaded by the Swedes, the Poles, the Tartars from the south. It was really falling apart. And they'd had pretenders, the first, second, and third false Dmitry among them. And so they needed to choose. They needed to find a figurehead, a patriotic figurehead. And so they found this boy who was extremely young. He was only about 16. And he had a stammer and a limp. So he was not a very strong or formidable character. He was probably illiterate, and he was living with his mother in hiding at a monastery. And they sent from Moscow a delegation. And when the delegation arrived, his mother, it was a bit like a sort of Monty Python scene, because
yes,
the delegation of boyars and bishops and what have you arrived at the monastery, and they said to him, they sent a message up saying, "We've come to ask him to be czar." And the mother just said, "Go away." And the boy just burst into tears, because all the people who'd claimed the throne for the last sort of 7 years had all been killed one by one. And there was no kingdom left, really. And so they refused to be czar, but the people insisted. And in the end, they accepted the throne for Michael Romanov. And he was really a kind of quite a distant connection to the last tsars of the Rurikid dynasty, the sort of legitimate dynasty. They were descended through Ivan the Terrible's first wife and his first sons. And so, it was really a tenuous link, but there was no one else who was the combination of innocence and simplicity and yet the touch of sacred monarchy, sacred dynasty about him. So that's why they chose him. And he had a long reign. He was not a very particularly good leader, not a particularly good czar, but him and the people around him put together, recreated Russian autocracy, and reconquered gradually over 20 years. They reconquered Russia from these invaders, and their success laid down the role of the Russian leader, which you still see today, which is as a sort of military commander. Before then, there'd been a kind of sacred, almost priest-like position. And he changed the nature of Russian rulership. Even though he was not a commander himself, and in fact was not very good at anything, but his son succeeded to the throne, Alexei. And when a new dynasty is successful, that's the foundation for longevity.
I liked Alexei. So he was conservative, wasn't he?
Essentially conservative, yes.
But he always comes across as rather a good chap to me.
Yeah, Alexei. I mean, he was the father of Ivan of Peter the Great.
So I love his indignance after we behead Charles I.
Yeah, he was very indignant. But a lot of basically all kings were pretty indignant after we beheaded Charles I. But the thing about him was that he also had a bit of a temper. Remember, he was riding along one day and somebody sort of approached him, and he stabbed them with his staff and killed them, because all czars carry these very pointed staffs. Ivan the Terrible had actually killed his own son with his staff, and Alexei killed someone, just an innocent passerby, with his, because, you know, these things happen in Russia. But But yes, he was actually an extremely impressive character. He ruled for a long time. He started the sort of conquest of what we now call Ukraine. And he was intelligent. And he really laid the foundations, founded by his father, but he really laid foundations for the Romanov dynasty and for the creation of the state, the Russian state, which was still called Muscovy. And it was still essentially a Muscovite state, not yet an early modern empire as it became. But he was extremely tall and very interested in the mechanics of things, very interested in guns and buildings. And so it was not surprising that his son was Peter the Great.
Not at all. And I love Peter the Great. He is one of my all-time favourite historical characters, partly because he's absolutely bonkers. But there's a reason he's absolutely bonkers. Sophia, did you cover her much in the book?
Yeah, Sophia, his sister.
Yes.
She's in the book a lot. And there are a lot of fascinating women in this book, by the way. Mm. One of the fun things about the Romanov dynasty is that, there was a whole century when Russia was essentially ruled by women, which I'm sure we'll come to in a second. But
yes,
they were Russia, which is quite a chauvinistic country. I think I'm safe in saying that even today, even in the 21st century, was ruled by these really astonishing selection of women, some of whom were really very gifted, some of whom were kind of complete ogres and monsters out of kind of Game of Thrones. But Peter the Great was that very rare thing. He knew what he wanted to do. He had the acumen himself to do it, and he had the resources to achieve the things he wanted to achieve. So those are the three kind of essentials, aren't they, of politics. And you're right, he was an absolutely extraordinary character. I mean, he was 6'7". He was a giant, a proper giant, with twitches. He regularly had fits. He was a very strange person. But he was also had the constitution, the iron constitution of an ox. And he also had a very short temper. He was fascinated with how things worked and how you took them apart. Ships, cannons and guns, but also humans. And when he tortured people, he tortured them himself. His dentistry. And when he launched terrors, which he regularly did, he was very paranoid and ran his own secret police effectively. And when he arrested people, including his own son, he tortured them to death himself by hand. But at the same time, he was very fascinated, you're right, by bodies and dentistry. He studied anatomy in Holland, and then he bought a whole lot of tools, surgical tools, and he liked to try them out on his own courtiers. And if you said, I've got a sore foot or I've got bad, my teeth are aching, he'd insist that he pulled out your teeth or cut or amputated your foot himself. And so after a while, people learnt if you had any kind of ailment or ague or aching, you certainly didn't mention it in front of the emperor.
Doesn't he have still in St. Petersburg, is there not a museum of inane tat that he accumulated? Just
yeah, he's got
insanity.
He's got his Kunstkammer, his curiosities.
Mm.
He was fascinated with kind of babies with their heads joined together or with two heads, or he was very fascinated by the heads of the people he cut off. When he executed large numbers of people, he did it himself a lot. And what he was very interested in was how long people sat up after he'd chopped their head off. By the way, one of the people he was chopping their head off really impressed him, because when it was his turn to be beheaded, he stepped forward and he just kicked the head of the man before him out of the way. And Peter said, that's a brave man. I'm going to spare him. And he spared his life and let him go, which was very, very Peter. That's very Petrine behavior. But basically, he created modern Russia. He had a vision. He changed Russia from a Muscovite state in capitals in Moscow. He changed the nature of it from a religious remote Asiatic state to a European state. He created the Russian Empire. He defeated the Swedes. who challenged him. Charles XII, the King of Sweden, invaded Russia. And it was the first of those great invasions, of which there are three, of course, Charles XII of Sweden, Napoleon Bonaparte and Hitler. All of them failed. And the latter two should have looked back to Charles XII, because Charles XII was a brilliant commander, but he was beaten by Peter the Great. And Peter the Great commanded his own army at that battle and won it. And of course, that put great pressure on all the other male Romanovs who followed, because they all wanted to be Peter the Great. Peter the Great was the one to copy. And I should add that on top of the politics, I mean, he really was a fascinating person. When you read his letters, he would literally threaten people. He'd say, like, if you don't do what I tell you, I'm literally going to come over and knock your teeth out. And he would. But he was also, he was also the Iron Man of international historical partying.
And yes. Is it the Society of Bacchus?
The Society of Bacchus and much else. I mean, it was very like sort of Led Zeppelin on tour, but worse, but with death. I mean, several of his top ministers died of alcohol poisoning during his parties. People were killed during his parties. At one point, somebody stabbed a servant to death with a fork. They got so drunk. And regularly, Peter the Great himself would just pass out under the table. They couldn't have been less politically correct. There were naked girls, dwarfs.
Lots of dwarves.
Giants, dwarfs, and lots of girls, and a lot of sex, and vomiting, and dying. It was just, and, you know, things were just, whole houses were destroyed. And regularly, Peter the Great suddenly turned kind of political, accused someone of corruption, and then beat them, and sort of, you know, knocked their faces in. So he was altogether the man who created Russia as we know it, but also one of the most terrifying tyrants of history.
Yes, I absolutely love that he also spent a spell living in Deptford as well.
Oh, the Deptford Peter the Great is very important. The orgies that he had in Evelyn's house, where he destroyed a whole sort of rather courtly mansion. He destroyed it. He played him and his courtiers got drunk, defecated everywhere, wiped their bottoms on the curtains, and then played wheelbarrow races in the garden and destroyed all the hedges. He spent some time in London, and he visited William III in Kensington Palace, which is, I always look at Kensington Palace. I don't think of Princess Diana. I think of Peter the Great.
Well, they have the famous portrait, don't they? Is it Kensington Palace? Yeah. Is it Lely?
Yeah. And they have, but anyway, he is just a person who you just can't, he's one of those fascinating people. You cannot find out enough about him. But a very, very, but very, very interesting person as well. Very interesting, talented.
I think one thing that really interests me about Peter the Great is you would expect such a rampant man to produce a male line worthy of his name. But he doesn't, does he?
No, I mean, this is always a problem if you kill your heir, if you kill your eldest son, especially in an era when child mortality was quite high, so people did die a lot. You know, children die, often didn't make it to adulthood. So it's very unwise. Of course, you know, Russian tyrants found it very hard to control their heirs, their sons. And just as Ivan the Terrible had killed his, so Peter the Great drove his son to revolt, and the son escaped, and Peter brought him back and then beat him to death and tortured him to death. Which is quite something, to kill your own son. Not many leaders have done that, though quite a lot have, actually, come to think of it. Constantine the Great, Abbas the Great of Persia, Herod the Great. A lot of greats kill their own sons. Interesting.
Maybe that's how they get the title, because they eliminate all other competition, even if it's their own child.
Probably, that's probably true. But you're right, he leaves... One of the most interesting things about him is his love life. And he had an amazing... he had an amazing love life. I mean, he actually executed one of his mistresses and walked with her to the scaffold and kissed her, and she thought she was going to be let off because she had an affair with the emperor, and he just said, "You've got to die." She aborted her babies, her newborn, her baby. She exposed her babies. which were born out of wedlock. And she was caught, and she was very beautiful and very young. I mean, she was 19, I think, when she was executed. And when she was executed, she was Scottish. She was called Hamilton. And when she was beheaded, Peter the Great went and got the head out of the basket and kissed it on the lips and then dropped it into the basket. And of course, even the Russian crowd who were not too shockable, they just gasped in horror, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I always found a lot of parallels between her and Catherine Howard.
Yeah. That's true. But, you know, the interesting thing was that he was also very meritocratic. He wasn't really very interested in marrying kind of princesses or aristocrats. You know, the love of his life, who became Catherine the First, the Empress Catherine the First, was really a camp follower, not much senior to a prostitute. She'd had affairs with all sorts of people. She'd been captured naked and marched into the Russian camp, literally naked. And he saw her, and she became his laundress. And then he married her, had children with her. And you know, when he died, he left the throne to her, who was not only not royal, but not even noble. I mean, she was literally a peasant's daughter. And she became the first empress in her own right in modern history. And really, that is, I mean, forget Napoleon Bonaparte. Catherine the First is the most meteoric rise of any person in the last history of the last 500 years.
And then after her, we go to Elizabeth.
Yes, well, Elizabeth is just was the daughter of Catherine the First and Peter the Great. So she was Peter the Great's daughter. So she was a giant. She was what we'd call a glamazon these days. She was blonde, blue-eyed. She rather than Catherine the Great, it was Elizaveta who was really a kind of great sexual enthusiast and liked to have many lovers at the same time. And because she was the emperor's daughter, she did exactly what she liked in life. She was also, I think, intelligent and able, and actually really laid the foundations for Catherine the Great. She was really one of the first great female rulers of modern times, and she was also cruel like her father. She could be very cruel. She had one of her ladies in waiting. She had her head shaved when she was jealous of her hair. Another, she had her tongue pulled out. So she could be extremely cruel, and she was a pretty frightening character. But she also loved cross dressing. So she was there something rather intersectional about her, as we'd say today. And she loved dressing as a man. And when she had balls, she made all the men dress as women and all the women dress as men, because she had a very good leg. And in those days, you know, men's legs were very admired, but you never saw women's legs, obviously, under these huge dresses. But she had rather good ones, so she wanted to show them off. So she made everyone cross-dress, which is extremely modern, isn't it?
I think, but then she doesn't have an heir, so she has to go looking for one. And unfortunately, and I've been accused of really not giving this next Romanov enough credit, but I just can't see where it is to give, if I'm honest. Do you agree or disagree?
Yes, there's nothing. There's Peter the Third, Emperor Peter the Third, who was her nephew, succeeded Elizaveta, and he was really without. Well, I think he was worse than wet. He was vicious. I mean, he was vicious, and he managed in 6 months, he managed to alienate every single part of Russian society. The nobles, the church, the people, the foreigners, everybody, the women. He alienated everybody in a very short time by being an extremely, you know, obnoxious character. I wonder if he was mentally, you know, if he was mentally challenged in some way. You know, it's hard to tell, but he was.
There seems to be a distinct lack of any cognitive reasoning, doesn't there?
He lacked empathy. You know, he lacked empathy. He couldn't read people, and that was a very dangerous fault to have. Ruling Russia is all about a ferocious vigilance at all times, and that ferocious vigilance requires a bit of paranoia, but it also requires subtle reasoning and the ability to win people over at all times. And the great Russian rulers could do that, using a mixture of terror and favor. But he really couldn't. And he was unlucky in that he married a 14-year-old German princess from a minor principality who was left on her own in Russia at 14 years old, not speaking Russian, but she learned Russian very quickly. And she, of course, was really, you know, the star of the 18th century, probably the greatest female ruler in all of history, Catherine the Great.
Absolutely. It's just a pity for him that he married a competition he absolutely could not beat.
He could not beat her. Catherine the Great had everything that he didn't. And the strange thing was that, you know, she wasn't even Russian, as you know, she's German. But she was attractive. She had lovely auburn hair, good lips, good blue eyes. But she was also highly intelligent, almost a nerd in her reading. Mm. Yet she was also highly physical, uninhibited, sensual, energetic. And then she had something else which is so essential in politics: charm. She could charm anybody. She famously made friends with all that she made friends with all the men. All the men wanted her. And she used them and chose who she liked. She was a great enthusiast for sex and for friendship, by the way. She was a great friend to have. She was loyal to her friends forever. She wasn't promiscuous for its own sake. She believed in love, and she said, I can't be an hour without being in love, without love. And she was really a serial monogamist, what we'd call today, but she was also extremely tactical. So when she was a teenager at the Russian court, she made friends with all the old ladies at court. She realized that they were very important. And she learned the name of all their dogs and parrots and cats. And, you know, she understood that it's detail, it's personal contacts that make the difference in politics. Politics is about people. And she understood that.
I have always had a soft spot for Alexander the First.
Well, Alexander the First was Catherine's grandson, and she also, like Peter the Great, like Ivan the Terrible, she hated her son, Paul. And Paul the Mad succeeded her as emperor, and everyone predicted, and she predicted, that he wouldn't last long as emperor. And sure enough, he was assassinated in the most brutal assassination, where people hated him so much that when his assassins, first of all, they strangled him, but then they literally took turns stomping on his head until it was crushed. That's how much they hated him, which is quite something. So his successor was his son, Alexander the First. And Alexander the First had agreed to the killing of his own father. So this is, the Romanovs are quite a family. You know, this is a family where you've got, you know, sons killing their fathers, fathers killing their sons, wives killing their husbands. You've got cross-dressers.
It does make Game of Thrones look pretty lame at times, doesn't it?
Yes, you've got many sort of threesomes and ménage à trois with two women and men, and you could go on. But Alexander I is much underrated, and I think you're right, because he was up against Napoleon. You know, no one was as brilliant as Napoleon, and Napoleon was a self-made man, and Alexander I was nothing like as talented as Bonaparte. But he learned his lessons. I mean, he screwed up. He screwed up very badly at the very great battles against Napoleon, at the Battle of Austerlitz, because he wanted to be Peter the Great. He wanted to be a great commander. They all did. And he wasn't. He just wasn't. But once he'd survived the burning of Moscow and the fall of Moscow by Napoleon, he suddenly found strength and a certain determination, and he put together the coalition that destroyed Napoleon, and he led his armies from Moscow all the way to Paris, and he took Paris. That's quite an impressive performance. And you know, on top of that, you know, he really did bring Russia to the top table as a great power. And it's interesting because when Joseph Stalin in 1945 took Berlin, the American ambassador said to him, congratulations, Generalissimo Stalin, you took Berlin. And Stalin, quick as a flash, said, yes, but Alexander the First took Paris.
Did he then, though, decide he'd had enough of all that and fake his own death?
I don't think he did. I think he died. But he is one of those great mysterious characters. I mean, he specialized in being mysterious. When you're brought up at the court of Catherine the Great, and then at the court of your father, Mad Paul, who was really a brutal curmudgeon, you learn the art of hiding your feelings, of masking your feelings. And in fact, all life at the Russian court, at all times, including now with Putin and earlier with the Soviet leaders too, was all about masking your real views. That's essential at the Russian court.
Do you think that Russia's history would have turned out to be different had Alexander II not been assassinated when he was?
Yes, I think it could have been different. I do believe that personalities can change history. I mean, you see that, I'm sure we'll come to the Russian Revolution a bit later, but you see that with Lenin, clearly. I mean, without Lenin, the Bolshevik Revolution wouldn't have happened. Without Stalin, the Russian revolutionary Soviet state, the Soviet Union, I don't think would have lasted in the way that it did. So there are examples where men and women really do have an influence. And I think Alexander II, he was planning to bring in a sort of representation assembly that would have led to more. He was a sort of liberal. Though he still believed in autocracy, but he could have, he could have changed history. I mean, he was really kind of looking at sort of reforms in a Europe where Napoleon III and Bismarck had both brought in universal suffrage, and kept autocracy. So bringing in a sort of assembly, didn't necessarily mean he was planning to deconstruct the Russian autocracy, but it was a start, and I think it could have changed the whole history of Russia. And Lenin, by the way, who, obviously was a brilliant student of power, thought that it could have gone either way. So that's interesting, and I agree with Lenin on this occasion.
Yes, on this occasion, stipulated.
Not always. I don't always agree with Lenin, but in this case, I think he was right, and I respect his point of view.
I have to say, brief though he is, anecdote worthy is Alexander III, isn't he? I love the one about the Austrian general saying he was going to send X amount of divisions into Russia, and him tying a spoon in a knot and throwing it on his plate and saying, well, that's what I'm going to do to your divisions. And of course, there's the ripping the roof off the train as well, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, he was unintelligent. And he was physically a giant. He lifted up the train. He lifted up the roof of the train when people were trapped under it. He was immensely strong. He could tear up kind of phone books and packs of cards. So he was literally a giant and very strong. But he was also really a capable ruler. He sort of understood how to manage people. Though everyone was terrified of him. He was really the Tsar also that really introduced fetishistic, obsessional anti-Semitism to the Romanovs had always disliked Jews. But Alexander III really, you mentioned the trains. I mean, for example, when he was driving his train, his train was going too slowly. He said, obviously the Jews are driving the train. Tell them to go faster. Even that he blamed on the Jews. He hated the Jews. And he brought up his son, Nicholas II, to absolutely hate the Jews. And, this attitude was not just racist, but it was also deeply unwise. But, Alexander III was an interesting character too, because he really died of alcoholism and he was a huge drinker. And when the doctors and his wife banned him from drinking, he designed a special boot that contained flasks of vodka that he could drink so that even when he was supposedly not drinking, he could just reach into his boot and find there a secret stash of booze. And Trotsky said, you know, if he hadn't been an alcoholic, Russian history would have been different, because he was capable, he could hold together. He probably could have held together Russia much better than his very wet son.
This is the problem, isn't it? I think you can, with that kind of attitude, works if you are a huge, terrifying man. If yeah. you are Nicholas II, I mean, so I did a book on George V in the First World War. And to me, I think I just coined Nicholas as the wrong man with the wrong temperament in the wrong point in history and the wrong place. Like
That's
Russia when it's falling apart.
Yeah.
The onset of the First World War. He wants to be an autocrat like his father and be his father, but he just also doesn't ever want to offend anybody to their face. So that's never going to work. And then so we have utter disaster, don't we?
Yes. I mean, he was so, you summed it up very well. I mean, he was first of all sort of physically very unimpressive, which really matters in Russia for some reason, you know, really, you know, the machismo. Is really important in Russian rulers, and you only have to look
at Putin with his shirt off in the lumberjack thing. Yeah,
exactly. You see Putin and his, you know, you Putin hunting tigers, diving, riding horses bareback, all of that. It's very, very important. I mean, Peter the Great was out there. You know, he could cut down trees. He was, you know, he could fire guns. He could build ships. And you even have to look at Yeltsin, you know, to see in our time, you know, just. He was a drunk, of course, but he was an impressive, big man, you know, a real mujik, as they say in Russia. But you know, Nicholas had none of that. But he was also rigid, unimaginative. He was not unintelligent. He was more intelligent than his father, I think. But he was also extremely arrogant, extremely inflexible, and worse than that, he really did believe in his religious mission to rule Russia as an autocrat. And that was a problem. Another problem was that he was extremely duplicitous. I mean, his image, because he died in the way he did, is of a sort of noble martyr that should have, you know, but actually, I think he was a very unpleasant man, really. He was very polite. People said they'd never met a politer man. So he had beautiful manners, beautiful voice, beautiful blue eyes. But behind your back, he'd immediately betray you. So his ministers didn't trust him. And they compared him to Emperor Paul the Mad, because you never knew where you were with him. He'd be very friendly to you. And when you go home, someone else would sack you. So yep. No one trusted him. No one trusted him in his own government. And that was to be a huge problem later when the crises came.
And the sort of faffy multiple attempts at dispersing power that didn't ever really please anyone entirely, and then backtracking on it as well. He did really dig his own grave, didn't he?
If he died before 1905, just in, if he died in 1904 after 10 years, he would have been regarded as quite successful because you know, he'd expanded Russian power into Manchuria and Korea, and that was really the only way it was left for Russia to expand. And Russia, a Romanov Tsar, it was in his blood to command in battle and to expand the empire at all times. It was unthinkable that a Russian Tsar could be anything but the ruler of a great power and an expanding empire. And so he found the only way left him was to go east. But the trouble was that he encountered a rising power, Japan, there. That led to the war, which he handled appallingly. And that led to the 1905 revolution, where he had to concede. He had to concede a constitution, which he hated to do. So he spent the rest of his next 7 or so years clawing back power to regather his autocracy. And he did that very, very effectively, actually, surprisingly. So by 1914, he was once again autocrat in effect, and he'd really held all the levers of power. But of course, just like Kaiser Wilhelm II, his enemy in Germany and his cousin, he just wasn't capable of handling, you know, the very complicated task of running a modern war.
Well, especially then, not when he detaches himself to go to headquarters, and that's the worst possible place. I think he sealed his own fate when he left the capital. That's yes. always I mean, been my opinion. But
yes, it was a big mistake when you went to the army. Mm. But I've got to remember that actually no one knew how to fight World War One when it started. And he wasn't alone in that. I mean, if you remember, Asquith couldn't really fight World War One. He had to be replaced by Lloyd George.
Yep. The 3 days off a week didn't help, did they? The long weekend we still wanted.
Yeah, and even the Germans, who really kind of did more than any other country to sort of promote the war at the beginning of it, to launch the war, even they actually couldn't run it. And the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, and the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, they couldn't run the war either, and they were replaced by Hindenburg and Ludendorff. And the same happened in France when they had to bring in Clemenceau. So in all the combatants actually did not know how to fight a war. And so that wasn't what made Nicholas II unique. What made it bad was he could not adapt, and he actually got worse and worse and more isolated and more rigid as the war went on.
He did indeed. I have to ask you, is it Catherine? Is she your favourite Romanov?
Yes, Catherine and Potemkin are my favourite too. I mean, that's such a romantic relationship and such an amazing political partnership, which is so rare between a man and a woman. And because the woman was the sovereign, the man wasn't completely dominant, which is unusual, of course. And yet, what was remarkable about her was she chose someone to help her who was as brilliant as her, as talented as her, as intelligent and capable, with the same acumen and the same vision. And so what you get is something so unusual, isn't it? Because we're so used to sort of couples where, you know, Eva Peron or Napoleon and Josephine, where actually it's all about the man, really. But this, because of the circumstances, and because Catherine was the ruler and the autocrat, it was a relationship that was so complicated and yet strangely equal. And their love letters, which are all in the book, if you want to read them, are a mixture of, you know, sexual passion, but also pragmatic politics, power. So they're just about everything in life, from power and art and war and love and sex to hemorrhoids and health. So all life is in these letters. And, you know, you can hear the way they talk, which is a wonderful thing. So I think Catherine is my favourite, probably, yes. But I have a soft spot for Alexander II, too.
For trying.
He was just more decent than most. Mm. And the Romanovs are really a pretty monstrous power family. And they really would do pretty much anything to keep power. They were very brutal. They were very racist. They were very unsympathetic, a lot of them. I mean, Nicholas I, we haven't mentioned, was very, very much like Vladimir Putin in his sort of...
Always found him quite unsavoury.
Yeah, he was an unpleasant...
He's sinister, unpleasant, isn't he?
Yeah, and he was like Putin. He just took advantage of Western fecklessness and was actually very, very effective, you know, very effective, a great opportunist. Though, of course, he was destroyed in the end by the Crimean War. But that's another story, isn't it?
It is. I could go on all day. Simon, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about the Romanovs. People have been bugging me, and I know I've been bugging you as well. But thank you for coming on to lovely. Talk to us it's through been... 300 years of amazing history.
Well, it's lovely to be here on your site doing a podcast with you. Let's do lots more. And that's been really nice talking to you.
Definitely. And next time you can pick the topic. I won't railroad you with my favourite Romanovs.
Okay, you're on.
Deal.
Thank you so much.
What are you working on now? You're doing a new book, aren't you?
I'm doing all sorts of different things, actually. I'm not ready to talk about it quite yet. But I'll tell you what I have done, because I'm not quite sure where it's going to go. But what I have done is I've been writing, and it's just coming out, is a new version of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. The biography. And the original, the one that came out in 2012, went up to the year 2000. But I've updated it to now. So it goes right up to Trump and Obama and Netanyahu and Arafat and even MBS and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. So it's really up to date and it's coming out right now.
Brilliant.
A new edition updated. So that's one of the things I've been doing, and that's been fascinating.
amazing. And we look forward to hearing about the other thing when you're ready to share.
I can't wait.
Join us tomorrow when Helen Doe will be with us to talk all about smuggling. This is absolutely brilliant. This is exactly what I wanted. It was tales of naughty people down in Devon and Cornwall and bringing things over from France, when, why, how, and what happened to the industry. So don't miss out on that one.
We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.